ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Tuesday, the 25th of November. I'm Sabra Lane in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. DoorDash and Uber Eats drivers will soon earn a minimum wage after the company struck a deal with the Transport Workers Union. It's a world first. It means delivery drivers will earn a minimum hourly rate rather than just a percentage of each delivery they make. But will it make your home deliveries more expensive? Angus Randall reports.
Eric Ireland started delivering for Uber Eats 6 years ago when his PhD scholarship ran out, and he's kept doing it part-time since. He only makes money at the end of a delivery, so if he's stuck waiting for an order, it's time he's not getting paid.
One thing that happens a lot is that you will sit there once you've got a job and you'll be waiting at the restaurant, and it might be a really busy time, but you're not actually earning any more money normally by waiting.
Drivers for Uber Eats and DoorDash in Australia are set for world-first hourly minimum wage standards after a deal was made with the Transport Workers Union. It should mean drivers avoid wildly fluctuating wages depending on factors out of their control.
When there's, you know, I guess there's a lot of drivers on the road and there's not enough work, and then you can just sit there and, you know, make hardly any money at all. It's really satisfying to know that there can be some kind of minimum from now on.
If approved by the Fair Work Commission, Uber Eats and DoorDash would need to ensure drivers earn at least $31 per hour worked and pay the difference if required. Michael Kane is the head of the Transport Workers Union.
For years, these workers have languished below the minimum wage in Australia, and that's simply not good enough. These companies came into Australia, pushed workers outside of the normal protections.
Beyond the pay rise, other benefits include some insurance and workers' compensation. With Uber and DoorDash, some of the biggest players in the gig economy, Michael Kane believes these changes will set an important industry standard.
If a worker is injured, they are able to get some compensation for that injury, some support on the way through and back to work.
So where's the extra money coming from? Uber Eats currently charges a 30% commission on every order, so it could increase its fees for restaurants or customers, or both, to make up the shortfall. Michael Kane hopes these massive multinational companies will foot the bill, but he believes Australians will accept a jump in costs if they know where it's going.
If you asked the average Australian, would you be okay if you paid a few cents more for your delivery, knowing that the worker who's knocking at your door has proper pay, is appropriately looked after if they're injured, and has terms and conditions that can ensure they can look after themselves and their families, I think that most Australians would say yes to that as well.
Dr. Alex Veen is a senior lecturer in work and organisational studies at the University of Sydney. He expects the answer to who pays is somewhere in the middle.
It's likely consumers will have to pay slightly higher prices for their deliveries. It may come somewhat from the restaurants who are using these services. And we may also see that the platforms are having to perhaps give up some of their cut.
In a joint statement, Uber, DoorDash and the Transport Workers Union say the proposals strengthen protections and provide certainty for thousands of workers.
Angus Randall there. A federal Labor MP is calling on his own government to take stronger action to tackle gambling harm. Dr. Mike Freelander says there's support within the party's ranks to crack down on gambling advertising, and it's a call back by independents and politicians from other parties. Here's political reporter Evelyn Manfield.
The Prime Minister's answer couldn't have been briefer.
Is it the government's position that relentless gambling advertising online on vulnerable Australians is acceptable?
Call to the Prime Minister.
No.
A one-word shutdown in question time. Sitting across the chamber, Liberal Simon Kennedy.
I interjected actually at the time and said that doesn't look like leadership, and it doesn't.
He's among the parliamentarians frustrated the government hasn't responded to a report by late Labor MP Peter Murphy on tackling gambling harm, more than 2 years after it landed. With support from across the parliament, the report made 31 recommendations, including a ban on all forms of advertising for online gambling, gradually over 3 years.
They're looking at social media bans for kids under 16, yet they are perfectly happy for kids watching the AFL Grand Final, the NRL Grand Final during the day, just before it starts to be pushed, you know, gambling advertising ads for 6 or 7 year olds. So don't they think there's a risk at harm for those children?
He's also co-chair of the newly revived Parliamentary Friends of Gambling Harm Minimisation, alongside Independent Kate Chaney and Labor's Dr. Mike Freelander. Dr. Freelander says if a ban on gambling advertising was put before Parliament and a conscience vote took place,
I think we would get support across the Parliament.
A sign his fellow backbenchers want action.
I think that most reasonable people can see the harm that gambling is doing. We're seeing how it's being normalised for children. The marketing is very powerful and very insidious.
Tomorrow, the parliamentary group will meet. It includes members within Labor's ranks. Chief Executive of the Alliance for Gambling Reform, Martin Thomas, will address the group and hopes stronger action comes soon.
The part of gambling that is skyrocketing at the moment is online gambling and people betting on their phone. And none of these companies have shop fronts. All of it is driven by a tsunami of advertising. There are a million ads on our screens every year from gambling. And that's what's leading us to be the biggest losers in the world. We lose $32 billion more per capita than any other country on the planet.
Communications Minister Annika Wells says the government has taken action, including banning the use of credit cards for online wagering and launching a self-exclusion register. Responsible Wagering Australia, which represents the local gambling industry, argues the real Wild West is offshore operators who avoid regulation. So ensuring local operators stay competitive is essential.
That report from Evelyn Manfield and Claire Armstrong. In the United States, a federal court judge has thrown out the criminal cases against former FBI Director James Comey and New York Attorney General Letitia James. US President Donald Trump handpicked the prosecutor in this case, and the judge found that appointment was illegal. Mr. Comey was accused of lying to Congress, and Ms. James was accused of mortgage fraud. I spoke a short time ago with our North America correspondent Carrington Clark.
This is a ruling from US District Judge Cameron McGowan Curry. She had been asked by the defence teams whether the attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia, Lindsay Halligan, had been legally appointed to her role. So Lindsay Halligan had previously served both as Donald Trump's personal lawyer and as a White House aide. So the judges noted that she had no prosecutorial experience when she was appointed and found that she had not been legally appointed. The background is that she was replacing another of Donald Trump's picks, Eric Siebert. He had refused to bring charges against Mr. Comey and Ms. James, even after Donald Trump had brought public pressure on his attorney general to do so. So basically the judge is saying normally attorneys have to be confirmed by the Senate. There is this option for the president to appoint people for a temporary role before they're approved. But basically because he'd already done that with Eric Siebert, he couldn't do it with Ms. Halligan. So it's a little bit procedural, a little bit technical, but this is a major blow to Donald Trump's ability to go after his political enemies. He'd already been acting outside the norm by putting public pressure on his attorney general to go after people who he had a personal gripe with. And this seems to be a real limitation the judiciary is putting on Donald Trump. Mr. Comey and Ms. James, effectively now, they don't have these charges against them. And obviously it's a major victory for them, although this does have some way to play out.
Yeah, what happens now?
Well, we are expecting that the Justice Department will appeal this ruling. One of the interesting characteristics, particularly with the James Comey case, is they were coming up hard against a limitation in when they had to bring these charges. There were just a few days on the clock, effectively, for when they could charge him. And he has been accused of illegally leaking information or authorising the leaking of information back when he was serving as the FBI director. So obviously that will be a question, that if these charges were brought illegally because the attorney was illegally appointed, whether or not they can effectively get an extension on that clock. But obviously this is also raising real questions about how the president is going about implementing justice in the United States. This is going to turn into a political dispute, as you would expect. But you would have to say at this point, this is a major loss for Donald Trump, and he will be very angry that the judiciary is once again checking his power as the commander-in-chief, as the executive here in in the United States.
Carrington Clark there in Washington. The Gaza ceasefire hasn't stopped all Israeli strikes in the territory, but it's allowed hundreds of thousands of Palestinians to flood back into areas from where they'd fled in recent months. And as they return to places like Gaza City in the north, many are discovering a deadly threat lying in wait, unexploded bombs scattered across the strip. And a warning, this report contains distressing details. Here's Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran.
It's a noise every parent dreads, the blood-curdling scream of a child. And for Latifa Al-Sharabsi, her worst nightmare came true last month.
Suddenly we heard the sound of an explosion, and I said to myself, the war is over, and we're in a ceasefire. Where did this sound come from?
Her six-year-old children, Yahya and Nabila, had ventured outside, and she found them lying in the street with serious injuries. The twins remain in hospital, battered, bruised and in immense pain. Yahya has lost his hand and doctors believe Nabila's leg may have to be amputated. Latifa said she hoped her children would be relatively safe with the ceasefire in place.
We were happy to come back from the south. We came back to our home and we were surprised. There were remnants of the war, looking like children's toys.
Earlier this year, the United Nations had received reports that around 21,000 Palestinian children had suffered war-related injuries. The International Rescue Committee said there had been up to 4,000 amputations for children since the beginning of the war, with Gaza already holding the record for the highest number of child amputations per capita in the world. Back in January, the UN estimated between 5 and 10% of the missiles and shells fired by Israel at Gaza hadn't detonated. Mahmoud Bassal is a spokesperson for Gaza's Civil Defence Agency, which is responsible for the Strip's emergency services.
About 71,000 of those missiles haven't exploded and are still lying on the roads and in the streets everywhere in Gaza.
The cleanup effort in Gaza is almost unimaginable, but it's becoming more and more clear by the day that it's not simply a case of moving rubble and rebuilding. Mahmoud says his teams can't clear the threat.
These specific cases need professional units and experts that can deal with these explosives, so it would not be dangerous for people dealing with or moving these remnants from one area to another.
For now, the Civil Defence Agency is focusing on education, warning people of the threats. Majdi Aslim is among those exercising caution.
When I arrived at my house in Gaza City, I was surprised it was still standing, even though there were tough military operations in the area.
But a missile had pierced through the building.
So this thing didn't let me get into my house. It's a very bad feeling. You have a home, but you can't live in it. You can't reach what you own.
While Majdi is still living in a tent, others are prepared to take the risk, including Azmi Dagmesh, who's sheltering inside a building despite a number of missiles in the vicinity.
Today, this house is not suitable for living, but we must live in it. Where else can we live?
The Israel Defense Forces refused to answer the ABC's questions about the threat posed by unexploded ordnance and what it was doing about the situation. This is Matthew Doran in Jerusalem, reporting for AM.
In some West Australian holiday hotspots, locals fear they'll never own their own home. Property researcher Cotalities just found one in three Australian markets now has a median house price of at least $1 million, including an increasing number of regional towns like WA's Margaret River. The town has just joined Australia's so-called Million Dollar Club. Jackie Lynch reports.
Come on, chickies. Amelia Glass grew up feeding chickens and swimming in the dam on her parents' regional property in WA's southwest.
I truly think it's the best place in the world to live.
It's a life the 20-year-old wants to return to once she's finished university. But her dream of owning a home in Margaret River, 270 kilometres south of Perth, is slipping further out of reach. The median house price in Margaret River is now $1 million.
And I always thought that Margaret River would be a cheap place to live because of the fact that we're so far from the city and we've got all these new housing developments going in, but hearing that the price has now gone up even more has kind of made the idea of living in Margaret River in the future a lot more daunting.
Even with the federal government's 5% deposit scheme for first home buyers, Amelia Glass says she'll struggle to buy in the place she loves. Just down the road in Dunsborough, the median house price is also more than $1 million. The once sleepy holiday town is buzzing with tourists and locals. And Dunsborough real estate agent Julie Fairclough says demand for houses is high.
It's extremely difficult to get a house definitely under 900 in Dunsborough now.
She says the market is showing no signs of slowing down.
It's just got that same vibe as the Byron Bay, north coast of New South Wales, that people love.
Caitlin Ezzie from property research company Cotality says 5 years ago, these kinds of seven-figure price tags were only really found in places like Sydney and regional tourism hotspots like Byron Bay.
It really started as this sort of prestige club that only a few suburbs across the country were part of. But given the strong value growth we've seen over the past couple of years, we've seen more and more markets enter that club. Currently about one-third of markets across the country have that million-dollar price tag.
Southwest planner Dane Gaunt says more houses are needed, but progress is slow.
We've got a housing crisis. We've got a planner shortage. We can't attract more planners to the region because they can't find housing. In terms of like specific barriers, enabling infrastructure is a big one. Power infrastructure and sewer infrastructure is massive and is causing a lot of delays.
He says it's a shared responsibility to fix the problem.
I see a lot of projects get caught up in process. And it might be at the federal level, it might be at the state level, it might be at the local government level. It might be process on the developer's side.
As Amelia Glass looks to the future, she's hoping for her own home, but fears the chance is slipping through her fingers.
If I didn't ever own my own home, I think I'd be quite disappointed. Australia is meant to be like the land where you can achieve all your dreams. It would make me very disappointed, and I would also feel like I hadn't worked hard enough to accomplish that goal.
Margaret River resident Amelia Glass sending that report by Jackie Lynch. Perinatal anxiety and depression can affect parents from pregnancy to a year after childbirth. Experts say while awareness has grown in recent years, those turning up for help are now experiencing more complex pressures. Isabel Masali reports.
West Australian mother Alison Gossage says looking after her firstborn was simple, but it wasn't the same for her second child.
He ate, slept, fed, did everything a baby should. And then my daughter was everything not that.
She experienced postpartum rage, a term she hadn't heard of before.
I would like black out. It was literally like a monster would come out of me. I would yell, scream, rage, throw things, you name it. And then I would like snap out of it like nothing happened.
After seeking support, she's now encouraging other parents to do the same.
They're not unfit mothers. It's normal. Like, mothering is hard.
We still as a culture portray this period of people's lives as a shiny and a happy time when families are forming and coming together. But we know for many people this change in self-identity and the feelings that they have as they navigate this uncertain time can really put them at odds with that.
That's Julie Bornenkorf, the CEO of Perinatal Anxiety and Depression Australia, or PANDA. The organisation supports the mental health needs of parents during pregnancy through to the first 12 months of a baby's life. She says about 1 in 5 new mums and 1 in 10 new dads suffer from mental health problems in this period, but she's particularly concerned about the latest data from PANDA's National Support Helpline.
There's been an increase in the experience of perinatal suicide and self-harm, risks in family and partner violence, and that the cost of living and all of the other crises we experience as a community are putting people under increased pressures.
Dr. Erin Seto is a clinical psychologist at another support organisation, the Gidget Foundation. She points to a range of symptoms depending on the person and their circumstances.
For anxiety, we're really looking at symptoms such as feeling anxious most of the time, ruminative thoughts, overthinking, and worrying a lot of the time. For depression, we're looking more at feelings of sadness and withdrawing and lack of motivation.
Dr. Seto explains the symptoms among men are more likely to be headaches, a lack of motivation, withdrawal, and feeling irritable or angry. Its recent national survey found 1 in 4 new parents who are experiencing these symptoms are not seeking professional help.
And I guess my guidance around that was, don't you be the determining factor. Go and seek support from a GP and let them help navigate that. You know, there's lots of different entry points into support, and what support looks like differs for everyone.
And she says that could be seeking peer support, an individual program or group program.
Isabel Masali reporting. And if you or anyone you know needs support, you can call Beyond Blue on 1300 22 46 36. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The devastating Optus outage that was linked to three deaths revealed we can't always trust we can get through when we call 000. More than 2 months later, surely the system has been fixed. Today, Consumer Affairs reporter Michael Atkin on why some people still can't get help when they need it most. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.